I have a disclaimer. If you want to live a good life, an easy life, a comfortable life, I suggest you don't read the Bible. Because it's just when we think that Jesus has gotten on board with our agenda, that Jesus has joined our side, that Jesus keeps talking. I mean, Jesus will say something, we agree with it, we'll nod our heads, but then Jesus says something else. And it steps on our toes, it makes us uncomfortable, it requires something of us, it makes it harder than it should be. Now, I realize that's probably blasphemous to say on a day that we gave Bibles to children, but let me redeem it by saying that at the same time, all the different types of stories and writings in the Bible, of all the different narratives in the Gospels, my favorites are when Jesus is taking questions from the audience, like his daily press briefings. You know, where a crowd has gathered. Some have come to be healed. Some have come to be fed. Some just want some wisdom. And then all of a sudden, someone shouts out a question. And Jesus gives an answer. If you've heard me preach over the years, you may have gathered that I'm particularly fond of these stories because they're the ones I choose out of the lectionary to preach most often. But I love them because we see Jesus on his game, riffing. No prepared statements, no teleprompters, just responding to whatever is thrown at him. I like it because we see Jesus in context. Jesus goes from this two-dimensional character in these soft pastel paintings to someone who is connected to real life, who has a nuanced personality, who's gritty and raw. And it's in these exchanges that we get some of the most profound spiritual insights and understandings of God. It's in one of these encounters that we hear Jesus come up with the parable of the Good Samaritan. In fact, most of the parables are told in these situations. And then there's the time someone shouts out, "Lord, teach us to pray." And Jesus gives us what we now call the Lord's Prayer. Also, these exchanges are often filled with tension. He says something we like, we nod our heads, but he keeps going. And he says something hard to hear. Rarely, actually never, does Jesus say, "It's all good, keep up the good work." There's usually a call for some sort of change in our lives. And usually it's hard. So there's this crowd gathered around Jesus. And it says it's a crowd in the thousands, so large that they're trampling one another. And Jesus is offering up some thoughts when some guy shouts out, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." And immediately we think, poor guy. His brother isn't being fair. He isn't getting what he deserves. I mean, the tension between brothers and inheritance is a story we've heard before. It's some of the earliest stories in the Bible. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau. But Jesus doesn't respond the way the guy wants. What he wants is for Jesus to say, "Yeah, brother, sharing is caring. It's only fair." But not Jesus. Instead, he says, "Who set me to be the judge and arbitrator over you?" In other words, leave me out of it. And I imagine both brothers standing there, and the older one who has the inheritance turns to the other one and says, "Ha ha, he told you." But Jesus isn't done. He goes on, he says, "Take care. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Now, in our context, it's hard to understand why Jesus calls this greed. These days, it's only fair for an inheritance to be divided equally among siblings. But in that day, it's the birthright of the oldest son. They get it all. The second is owed nothing. Sorry, Prince Harry. Just be glad you weren't born a girl. So we can understand Jesus' response better by knowing what this guy just asked was, Jesus, tell my brother to break all the cultural norms and practices and give me what society says I don't deserve. And on top of that, it's a little tone deaf. I mean, meaning, here is this crowd in Galilee, a bunch of hill folk, farmers and fishermen, many subsistence farmers living literally hand to mouth. And he thinks Jesus cares about his family inheritance. Most of the people in that crowd would have said, what's an inheritance? And if they were to get an inheritance at all, it would have been a small plot of dry, rocky soil or a leaky fishing boat. And here comes this trust fund baby whining about what he thinks he's entitled to. Like, read the room, man. But for us reading this in 2019, it's still not too bad, not too difficult. We get it, Jesus. Life doesn't consist of the abundance of possessions. Materialism and greed are bad. Noted. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He keeps talking. And this is where it gets uncomfortable. He tells a parable. A rich guy has a really good crop one year, he says. His land produces so much that he can't fit it all into his barns. So he decides to tear down his barns and build bigger ones to store his massive crops. And then the guy talks to himself. He says, I will say to my soul, soul? Now Jesus intentionally uses the word soul. He doesn't say, I will say to myself, self. He uses the word soul to clue us in that he's not really talking about crops and grain. He's talking about things much deeper. But the man says, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. That sounds great, doesn't it? This is the moment in life we're all waiting for. That moment when we realize we have enough or more. We've hit the lottery. Our ship has come in. No more stress. No more worry. Now we can enjoy life. We may not be poor hill folk from Galilee, but we certainly can relate to this guy. I have a good friend who worked very hard his whole career. 60, 70-hour weeks were routine. Vacations were sparse. He and his wife aggressively socked away money for retirement. And every year, they would meet with their financial advisor. And every year, my friend told their financial advisor the same thing. He said, I'm waiting for that green light to come on. I feel like there'll be a day when you're going to tell us that we've put away enough and we can retire and have the lifestyle we want. But we're not there yet, so the light is on red. But I'm waiting for you to tell me it's turned green. And then one year, their financial advisor said, sir, the light isn't green yet, but we're on yellow. And a couple of years later, they walked in his office and he said, the day has come, the light is green. In other words, eat. Drink, be merry. Now your life can begin, and now you can be happy. And so within a few months, my friend quit work. This is what he had set out to do, retire comfortably. But retirement was much harder than he thought. It threw him into an identity crisis. He had no idea who he was outside of his work. He was no longer an achiever, no longer a producer of anything. He had no idea what he wanted to do with his life or even how he wanted to fill his days. He could relax, he could eat, he could drink, but where was the merry? Now, for the rich man in the parable, it was much worse. After building bigger barns, and he tells himself it's time to live the good life, God says, you fool, this very night, your life is being demanded of you. It's a nice way of saying he dies. And God says, and now, who will get all you've stored up for yourself? It's a startling thought. After working so hard and waiting so long for this moment to come, it's all for naught. Instead, he dies and it all goes to waste. But Jesus isn't done. He keeps going. He adds one more thing, and he says, so it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God. Yikes. Is he saying that if we save money for ourselves, if we have a 401k, God's going to end our lives? I told you that if you want to be comfortable, don't read the Bible. I think maybe our struggle with this parable is that it articulates our expressed values, but not our lived values. Our expressed value is that life is greater than our possessions and wealth. We lift up ideals of simplicity and generosity. Or maybe they are our aspirational values. But our lived values are that we store up lots of treasures for ourselves. We believe our security is found in having enough. We need to fill those bigger barns as protection just in case. In the parable, God calls the man a fool, but in our current life, those who don't save are the fools. That's our lived value. So how are we supposed to bridge the gap between what we say we value, or what Jesus says, and what our lived value is, and the prudent, safe thing to do? Because I'm here to tell you, I'm not cashing in my pension just yet. If we listen again, I don't hear Jesus' critique in saving or preparing for an uncertain future. There's nothing inherently wrong with earning and saving. The critique comes when the man who wants his inheritance or the rich man in the parable think that's the meaning and purpose of life. Jesus doesn't have a problem with the rich man storing crops in his barns. Jesus has a problem when he builds bigger barns so he can save it all for himself. The criticism is that the man thinks that storing his abundance will make him happier and safer and more content, and that nothing more is required of him. The man says, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. Jesus intentionally uses this phrase, eat, drink, and be merry. It's a reference back to the book of Ecclesiastes that says, so I commend enjoyment, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. But Ecclesiastes goes on. For this will go with them in their toil through their days of life that God gives them under the sun. You see, the man in the parable is misusing this phrase to mean life is enjoyable only after you've worked hard and overcome trouble. Only when you have enough can you find meaning and joy. He thinks a life with full barns guarantees an easy life. But the original point of Ecclesiastes is that life is hard and there is pain. And we all suffer. And there's no escape from it. But there is meaning and enjoyment to be found in the midst of all of that. Life is hard, so eat, drink, and be merry now. It's not like there's some reward that comes after we've made it through. It's that our lives have greatest meaning when we can discover comfort within the pain. Or joy as a part of the work and toil of life. And no amount of money or possessions will protect us from the pain. When we make the purpose of life a reward we earn later, when we have enough to eat, drink, and be merry, life has little value. But we find meaning when we make merry in the process. My friend Ariel is a psychologist, and when she asks her patients what their goals are, they often say things like, "I just want to be less stressed. I want to be less tired. I want to be less angry, less sad." Ariel calls these dead man goals. Because as she says, a dead man isn't stressed. A dead person isn't tired. A dead person isn't angry. She says the thing she hears the most is, "I don't want to be in pain." And I get it. Pain is pain. No one wants to be in pain. But pain is a part of life. And pain plays an important role in keeping us safe. If we can't feel pain, are we even alive? The opposite of pain is numb. And numbness is no feeling at all. Ariel's point is we must seek goals that keep us engaged in life. Goals that seek something rather than avoid something. Goals that help us move through the stress and the weariness and the pain. When the rich man builds his bigger barns and stores enough to eat, drink, and be merry, it's nothing more than a dead man goal. You know, when God says, "You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you," I wonder if we could reframe that to not be that we are literally going to die, but what if we understand it that life demands much of us? It requires work, and there may be stress and pain. And there are no guarantees of security from the material world. And yet Jesus says, this is where we discover the beauty of life, the richness of life. It is where we experience the grace of God and find value in our lives beyond what we've acquired and stored. The assurance of God is that in the midst of the pain, in the midst of the stress, during the hard work, I am with you. I am with you now. So eat, drink, and be merry now. This is what one's life consists of. And it's being demanded of us. But Jesus isn't done. He goes on. But we're out of time today. So we'll get to that other part next week in part 2. Thanks be to God. Amen.